This is CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby, independent campus community radio from Simon Fraser University. We broadcast on the unceded ancestral territory of the Coquitlam, Musqueam, Squamish, and the Tsleil-Waututh. We also stream online at cjsf.ca and listen to podcasts of our programs and our website.
Music and talk radio about all things, all genders. This is Intravenous, live on CJSF 90.1 FM, discussing and approaching contemporary gender issues through a feminist lens. Our goal is to educate, engage, and challenge the dominant hegemony.
Hello, 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 and welcome to Intravenous on CJSF 90.1 FM. You're listening to campus and community radio broadcasting from Burnaby on the unceded Coast Salish territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations. My name is Nicole Hines, and I'm back after a two-week hiatus basking in the sun, and I've got to say that I'm really happy to be back. I'm not going to lie. I've spent 2 weeks enjoying some sun, and it was really good to see the sun back with us this morning after a rainy Monday. And it gave me a boost because the sun always does that for me. And I was really happy to be back to see how the cherry blossoms are so in full bloom out here in the Lower Mainland. So, yes, very happy to be back. Today's show, I am going to be sharing an interview by SFU student Zarina Mozaidi. And there are some interesting events happening this month, including one happening later this evening that I'm going to be talking about. And some of you may want to attend because they sound pretty awesome. So before I share the details about the first event, I'm actually going to play a clip that was produced by Maclean's magazine back in 2018, where Canadian women were asked the question, do you remember when you first learned that women statistically make less than men? Back then, on average, women working full-time in Canada made 26% less than men. Let's have a listen.
Do you remember when you first learned that women statistically make less than men?
I think I've always known it. I don't think I do. I feel like it's a known fact, like we know the sky is blue.
Probably would have been in university.
When I started signing other people's paychecks.
Childish innocence. You assume everyone is getting what they deserve.
I can't think of a time when I did not know that women make less than men on average.
We kind of grow up knowing things aren't quite equal.
It's still a problem, and it's always been a problem.
And I am much more concerned about what we're going to do about it than why it's happened.
But hopefully it is a reality we can actually change because it's one we created.
On average, women working full-time in Canada earn 26% less than men.
I went to university, played soccer, and then after that, I've been a full-time soccer player. Yeah, just the scale right now, unfortunately, internationally is totally different. If a men's team qualifies for a World Cup, they get, give or take, around $10 million. If a women's team wins a World Cup, they get $2 million that goes towards their federation, and that's all coming from FIFA.
You know, I overheard once someone saying, I'm not going to put her on a file, she just got married, she's going to go and get pregnant. These are things that are still said in the workplace.
I mean, I remember having guys that I work with that were my colleagues say to me, well, the only reason that you've been appointed to cabinet is because you're a woman.
It's so societal. Like, at this point, we need some real change when it comes to how genders treat each other and how they value each other.
A lot of the excuses that people make around the gender wage gap or around differential treatment of women or men tends to be around this idea of meritocracy, where they say whatever the outcome is, it's just because of pure talent. All of those excuses around meritocracy don't recognize the fact that we have a system that doesn't see women's contribution to the economy as valuable.
We tend to devalue the feminine. There's work that shows that when a job becomes overwhelmingly women, all of a sudden that job starts paying less.
As much as everyone likes to say, well, I like to work because I love it, it's not about the title, it's not about the money. Money is the collateral, it's the exchange, it's the value you're given for what you're doing and your contributions to work. So it's important to understand what your value is.
There's absolutely no reason at that point that men should be making more than women when they're delivering the same quality work.
There are provinces that have pay equity legislation. There's pay equity provisions at the federal level. I think everyone would argue we haven't done enough, but I think the other thing that we should argue at this point is that it's not working. Even in provinces where there is legislation, we're still seeing the numbers aren't changing. In fact, we now see from latest StatsCan reports that it's actually going backwards.
We're also too satisfied looking just at how much men are making versus how much women are making, when the reality is women who are Black, who are Indigenous, who are disabled, newcomer, these women are all making a lot less. So we're missing a lot of nuance by strictly talking about gender.
Whenever you have somebody with power over someone else, it's a dangerous situation, whether it's a difference in gender, in race, in faith. Like, we have to make sure that people are recognized for what they are and that we're given equal place.
What research shows is that the gender wage gap actually emerges primarily through the fact that women, after the birth of the first child, end up changing careers or changing jobs because, again, they are the ones expected to do more of the childcare, to be more flexible, to do pickup after school. If we could fix one thing, having more equal participation at home for men and women would actually change the wage gap equation more than almost anything else we could do.
Maybe it's not a big, scary policy discussion we need to have for 3 years before we figure out how to do it. We know how to do it.
I think we've broken through this kind of veneer of everything's okay.
But we're kind of in this unique position where we have more of a platform than ever to do something.
An incredible example of someone I admire is Mark Benioff. It wasn't about why the pay gap was there. He just said, this is not the society of the future, and I'm going to fix it. And he literally took out a red pen, and he righted the wage gap in his company.
I found it really interesting looking at what some other countries are doing. Australia has a more transparent regime, so they're asking private sector companies in particular to start reporting if there is some sort of a pay gap, and what does it look like, how are they addressing it.
I actually think that it's really policymakers, leaders, corporate managers and people like that who are the ones who are going to have to change.
You need to look at the data first, you need to confront the data, you need to accept that there are inequities in your organization before you can do something about them.
I don't want to put the burden on young women to fix the problem. We can't expect to say there's a gender wage gap and then expect women themselves to fix it.
They do need you, and it's not about, they're not hiring you for anything but your skills, because that's what they want in the role. They're not a business is not a charity. They're hiring you because they think you're going to do a good job. So stand up for what you're worth and ask for in the beginning, so you're not always behind trying to catch up.
And so in that clip, we heard about the disparities in pay for men and women, and this issue leads to actually the first event that I want to share. Equal Pay Day is happening tomorrow, Thursday, April 16th, in British Columbia, and this day highlights the gender wage gap and is often recognized on different days across the country as well as around the globe, depending on the organization that chooses to highlight this issue. So, for example, in Ontario, various groups have recognized yesterday, Tuesday, April 14th, as the day to mark how far into the year women must work in order to earn what men did in 2025. So that means that women had to work 4 additional months to make what a man made last year. The income pay gap is even higher for Indigenous women, racialized women, migrant women, disabled people, older workers, and caregivers. In BC, an organization called West Coast Leaf highlights this issue to raise awareness about the systemic inequalities causing the gap, and they've recognized that tomorrow, April 16th, is Equal Pay Day in BC. West Coast Leaf is hosting a free virtual panel discussion tomorrow called Building Collective Power for Pay Equity Through an Intersectional Lens. It's part of their Income and Pay Gap series, and it starts from 12:30 to 1:30 p.m., so just an hour. You do have to RSVP to attend, so I will include the RSVP link in the show notes today, as well as the link to the West Coast Leaf website, just in case you want to get more information about this organization. There will be 3 panel speakers tomorrow. Sinan Bagon is the co-founder of the Vancouver Committee for Domestic Workers and Caregiver Rights. Sarah Jama is the manager of programs, the Disability Alliance of BC. And Veronique Siufi is the racial equity researcher and policy analyst at BC Policy Solutions. So I'm actually planning to join. I did RSVP, and I really look forward to this conversation because it's wild that I played an audio clip from 2018 and the issue is still kind of thriving in 2026. So now I am going to move on to another event that's actually happening later this evening in the Lower Mainland. If you don't already know, today is the National Canadian Film Day. It's also known as Cannes Film Day, and that is a massive coast-to-coast appreciation for Canadian cinema. The day launched back in 2014 and has allowed hundreds of thousands of Canadians to celebrate our stories and achievements of Canadian filmmakers. Some events actually involve public screenings, and some events involve like watch parties from the comforts of your own home. The Vancouver Queer Film Festival is offering a Pay What You Can screening of the film Parade Queer Acts of Love and Resistance, which is an award-winning documentary directed by Noam Gunick. And here are some details about the film. Spanning decades of resistance, Parade Queer Acts of Love and Resistance shares archival footage and first person accounts to trace the movements, communities, and acts of defiance that shaped 2SLGBTQI plus rights in Canada from the streets all the way to the House of Commons. So doors open this evening at 6:30 p.m. and the screening starts at 7, and it's taking place at Fifth Avenue Cinemas, which is located at 2110 Burrard Street in Vancouver. As I mentioned, the admission is pay what you can, and it's geared for those who are 19 and over, so just bear that in mind. If you can't make it out to this film this evening, you can still celebrate Camfil Day by heading over to their website. They have some areas on the website where you can check out some streaming platforms that have films that you can watch, or you can even check out their television section for films that you can enjoy at home. I'll have a link to this film, Parade Queer Acts of Love and Resistance, as well as the Camfil Day website in today's show notes, just in case you can't make it out and you do want to celebrate and participate. Now, I want to take a bit of a break, and we're going to listen to a track from, let's see, who's it going to be? Ah, Tanya Iyer. The song is called Don't Hold Me Hostage for Who I Am, for Who I Was.
Are you a fan of industrial and have been trying to find smaller artists? Have you only heard of Nine Inch Nails and are looking to get further into the genre? Maybe you're like that guy I met in my lecture who hadn't even heard of Linkin Park. No matter where you're coming from, Wire & Nerve is the show for you. 1 hour of all kinds of industrial, from Throbbing Gristle to Godflesh to Frontline Assembly and more. Tune in Mondays 7 to 8 p.m. only on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby.
Annual Sled Island Music and Arts Festival is back June 17th to 21st, presented by Service Credit Union. Experience 5 days of music, comedy, art, and much more in diverse venues across Calgary, Alberta. Joining Sled Island's previously announced guest curator, Clipping, is English chamber folk ensemble, Black Country New Road, revered Canadian pop project, Homeshake, renowned abstract rapper, Billy Woods, LA synth punk's Sextile, fuzzy indie rock outfit, Feeble Little Horse, outlandish egg punk group, Snooper, lo-fi post-punk duo, Sweeping Promises, New York City-based ambient pioneer, Laraji, genre-bending dream pop artist, Salami Rose, Joe Lewis, and many more. Plus, there are over 150 more artists still to be announced. Check out the current lineup and get your passes and tickets at sledisland.com.
Welcome back to Intravenous. You've been tuned into CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, broadcasting from the unceded Coast Salish territories. Next up, I have an interview by SFU student journalist Zarina Modzaidi, who chats with Rowan about a new chamber opera called The Fox.
Hello and good day. This is CJSF Radio on the unceded territories of the Squamish, Musqueam, Tsleil-Waututh nations. And today we are here with Roan for a description and introduction to Opera Unbound's first ever full-length production, The Fox, which is by Roan Shan Karuk, an emerging Vancouver-based composer who is the first to adopt this work by Lawrence into opera. The Fox is a 1922 novella set in an isolated English poultry farm, with the two main characters being these two women who are running the farm together. And the, I guess, climax and the tension in the story is of Henry, a young soldier who arrives and kind of disrupts the living environment of these two women. And so I think that Lawrence's work has always carried these themes of desire, power, and gender, and that's what we're going to be exploring in this interview today, just kind of how Roan adapted this work and why you should be in the theater watching this beautiful opera that will be playing at the Annex in Vancouver on April 17th, 18th, and 19th. And so I would love to introduce you to Roan. Would you like to give us a little introduction to yourself? It's so nice to chat with you today.
Yes, it's likewise. Yes, hello, my name's Roan, and I'm a Vancouverite forever. I've lived in East Vancouver my entire life, right on Commercial Drive, which I like to think is the coolest part of town, which is unbiased. But it's definitely one of the most artsy part of town, so you could probably write an opera just based off the people you see on the street. But I've lived there my whole life, and I've written songs since I was very young on the piano, and I went to a great, very musical high school in East Vancouver called VanTech. And then I ended up doing, I did tons of musical theater and even opera with the Vancouver Opera when I was young. And it led to me doing singing lessons and eventually going to UBC Opera for opera performance and composition. And I eventually did my master's at the University of Manitoba in the frosty north, which I enjoyed. I like the snow. And yeah. That's also where this opera was workshopped. I wrote it when I was in school in Manitoba.
Yeah. Oh, that's awesome. So from the classroom to the stage, how does that feel to kind of, I guess, close that loop of your journey?
Well, this is the first time this one will be fully performed. And it is amazing because it's the coolest thing about writing an opera is when you get people to perform it and they treat it like any other opera. Like the performance of this, they're as prepared and as knowledgeable about the story as if they were doing Mozart, which is kind of surreal when you're a composer. Not that I'm comparing myself to Mozart, but just the professionalism, just in general, no matter what the piece is. Yeah.
Totally. And also to have that be honored and treated as if it's not, I don't know, something that just came out of your head. I don't know. Sometimes that imposter syndrome can come out when you're a student and writing and creating. It must feel great to be in the field
I'm so used to putting things on my own, or I would say probably with help from my family. I did my first offer I wrote, I did it as a fringe show in 2019, I was actually late. I was late going to university because I had to stick around here for an extra week. But I think, I don't know if it's been beaten, but it was the first ever opera at the Vancouver Fringe. I don't know if there's been another one since.
That's very, I was going to ask you about your experience with the genre itself. Like, you chose to make this a chamber opera more than just an opera in general. What was that decision based upon?
In modern times, obviously, when you're starting out, you think, well, I have the resources to do, you know, a grand, giant, 4-hour long opera. And also, I think I really love a chamber opera. And I think a lot of modern audiences, it's such a good, like, scale to go out in an evening, because they're often, chamber operas are really intense. The stories, I mean, I find short stories are the best thing to adapt. So it's a very intense drama in like an hour and a half. And there's few characters, so you really get to know them and their ins and outs. And I don't know, I think it's just such a great genre, especially if you're doing, this isn't horror. I have done some other kind of more horror stories, but violent interpersonal clashes. Totally. You can really get into the details.
And having something that can also be consumed in one go sometimes when you're doing a big production or a big performance, the actors as well can lose in some ways their momentum. It's awesome to have it be very compact. And well, for our listeners who aren't, I guess, aware of what The Fox is, or what I guess your rendition of this classic through chamber opera is. Can you give a little description of what the story is about and what drew you to this particular piece of literature to be adapted?
Oh yeah, well I every time I finish writing an opera, I've written a couple now. I just finished my fourth one. Look, it hasn't happened yet, but every time I finish one, I immediately gotta go to my. If we're doing a little video, I have my bookshelf behind me. I have so many short story collections, and I just start voraciously reading them until I find the next thing. And so I love classic literature, not only because a lot of it's in the public domain, so I don't have to get the rights. I could just go free and adapt it. But D.H. Lawrence's stories are so amazingly complex, and they are perfect for these kind of intense small operas, because all the characters are really passionate in often unusual and kind of, well, realistic ways. And so The Fox is about two women who, during the Spanish flu epidemic, so you could do it now with COVID, it would be very similar, the Spanish flu and just the tail end of World War One, and it's over a winter at their isolated farm, these two lifelong friends and farm owners together, Jill and March, and they have kind of a content life on this farm. It's not the most successful farm, so there's tension there with keeping it going, but they like their independence until, of course, a young soldier arrives called Henry, who immediately is drawn to one of the women, and she, for her part, is the reason why the story is so complex, is that nothing in it is clear cut. She is attracted to him as well, so there becomes quite a eventually, maybe, I don't want to give anything away, eventually a violent kind of love triangle between her and Jill, her long-term, you know, companion, and Henry. And then the other The other interesting thing about the story, and also why I love a little bit of surrealism, mm-hmm. is that the name is the fox, and each character is kind of represented by a different animal. Henry is, he appears, he has red hair, and you know, and they're being terrorized by a fox on their farm, and March mm-hmm. is kind of, she has the elements of like a rabbit, like a March hare, mm-hmm. and there's a lot of, so there's a strange element of kind of predator and prey and kind mm-hmm. of deer in the headlights thing between her and then her other friend, I think, is more of a chicken of a character.
Yes.
It's reflected in her demeanor. So, yeah, there's this very surreal, dreamy element of how much is there almost a mesmeric connections between these characters.
I love that.
So it's very fascinating.
Yeah, that's super fascinating, especially because I feel the nature resemblance, or I guess the ability to play with the kind of metamorphosis that these characters can transcend into leads to so much like depth when you're thinking about singing and like how to express, you know, the emotions when you're creating these songs. So you compose the entire production as well?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
How was that process of you know, moving words into song and song into movement and dance? I mean, were you also the director of this production, or?
This production, no, it's directed by a great local director called Chris Lamb, mm. who we've both had, he's done so many interviews, I think, for various different, he's done a lot of musical theater and plays, but I know he almost approached us because he really wants to get into opera. Because similarly, he likes that. A lot of opera stories, they're often not quite so, a lot of musical theater is very specific to what it is. It's hard to do mm-hmm. the Music Man in a lot of different ways. It is the story it is. Whereas a lot of opera stories do have a kind of open-ended, almost impressionistic view of stories sometimes, where it'll just mm-hmm. be scenes from a story, or in this case, a very hard to define plot.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he approached us, but he's been, a lot of elements in the story are hard to adapt on a stage, but he has had mm-hmm. amazing ideas of using shadows and silhouettes and kind of creating a set using almost puppet, like shadow puppets in places, mm-hmm. which I'm very excited about. We're not quite that far in the rehearsal process yet, but I look forward to it.
That's super exciting. Yeah, I feel like especially when you're making a chamber opera, which has to be so, I guess, narrative driven, it's mm-hmm. it's so important to have the depth of lighting production on stage and also just like props and stuff. Yeah, mm-hmm. I have some experience in theater growing up, and also I studied it in class. I'm an English major, so I did the Beggar's Opera. And
yeah,
I think
of course.
The Beggar's Opera was like learning about it, and I feel like you could probably apply it to most chamber operas, is that each scene is a vignette of this like moral problem or like kind of very human experience. So mm-hmm. while it is set in this maybe strange world or strange characters, it's super close to reality, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like, how did you find writing it and composing this? Like any moments that you got vulnerable about your own life and or situations that are happening in today's contemporary age? I mean, you talked about COVID, you know, being like similar to the Spanish flu kind of mm-hmm. Era drama, if that makes sense. Like how did you adapt this piece for a contemporary audience that's dealing with these kinds of tensions as well? Maybe